From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the opioid crisis in the United States now rivals the Vietnam War in how many Americans have been killed. After calling it a national emergency for months, the president has declared it a public health emergency, a distinction with a difference. It's Friday, October 27th. Aaron, how old were you the first time that you used an opioid?
14.
14. What kind of teenager were you then? Describe to me a little bit.
I was an athlete. I played a lot of sports. I played basketball, football, and baseball.
Aaron Pope lives outside Lexington, Kentucky.
I was not a bad kid. My dad always taught. My dad was a preacher. So, you know, he taught me to be well-mannered and well-behaved and respect your elders and stuff like that.
And were you a happy kid, would you say?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly.
So tell me about that first time.
Well, where I'm from, people sit and hang out in a parking lot after school. And I had a friend. We were sitting in his truck in the parking lot just hanging out with a bunch of people. Like teenagers do.
Mm-hmm.
This kid happened to have a hydrocodone. He was like, "Hey man, have you ever done a pain pill before?" And I was like, "No man, I haven't ever really messed with that stuff." He busted it up. He crushed the pill up and was like, "You got to try this." And there it was. So why not? It made me feel excited, like this was bold and new and cool, and not only that feeling, but the feeling of the opioid itself, which gave me this, like, I have arrived moment. And within maybe 3 months, I graduated to a heavier substance, and that was the one that really changed things. I had another friend that had been doing pain pills for a while. We were just talking one night, and he said, "You should try oxycodone." And I was like, "Well, what is that? What are those things?" And he said, "Get $30 and I'll show you." About an hour into it, there were deer standing on the side of the road that we were driving down, because we were just driving in the back roads.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember jumping out of the car, and I would venture to say that it was still moving a little bit.
Wow.
And chasing these deer through the field, like it just made me, like I was just like the Incredible Hulk. Euphoria is what I would use to describe it. That was the moment that I knew that these were the greatest things since sliced bread.
So how did you start getting the oxycodone?
That's a very interesting story. This was during the time where Florida did not have a way to track how many narcotics prescriptions people were obtaining from doctors. So at this point in time, you could go to Florida and get a doctor to write you a prescription for 30 milligram oxycodone.
That's a lot of pills.
And yes, and you could do that three different times.
Hmm.
So you're talking about 1,000 pills. And then you could come back to Kentucky and sell them for $30 a piece, no problem. It's a term called doctor shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Back in this time, it was oxycodone galore. Back in those days, you never had trouble finding oxycodone or oxycodone.
So what happens after that?
Around 16 and 17, I started selling to my classmates at school. Then I dropped out of school because I thought it was a fantastic idea to just pretty much do this full time, because I was making quite a bit of money.
How much would you say?
And let's see, 50 times 30 a day.
Wow. You were making $1,500, up to $1,500 a day.
Yeah.
Selling pills at $30 a pill.
Yes, every day. In a town, the next town over. I would say outside of this factory and wait for a second shift to come out and third shift to come in. And I would catch those guys. A lot of those factory workers were on pills and would take pills to keep themselves up at night or whatever they wanted to do. And I would just sit outside of that factory and just kill it. They would buy most of it. So pretty much the large majority of people in this time were using a lot of drugs, pills, just pills. I think people justified it a lot easier than they would cocaine or heroin or anything, just simply because
it was a pill.
They were manufactured and they were pills and they were prescribed to people every day. I think people would use that justification to justify them using
it. Is that how you felt yourself? It's like, how different is this than taking an Advil or taking the pill that, yeah, the doctor, there's something about a pill that feels okay-ish?
I can see that it was just so normalized at that point in time for everyone that was around me that was doing this. The streets were just littered with it. It was an epidemic. And people that you would never think were doing this were doing this. This is parents of people, parents of my friends, if not, their brothers, their older brothers, mm-hmm. or their sisters. Everyone did this. Even people who didn't do drugs eventually did this because it was so profitable. My mother eventually jumped on that train.
And which train did your mom jump on?
The distribution of narcotics.
And how did she become introduced to it?
I would say it was through me, seeing how profitable this was. She had a lot of things to pay for. My grandmother was in poor health, and there was a lot of, financial strife there. So she did what she thought was a rational idea, which we now know was not. And she went to Florida herself and brought narcotics back, and I helped her distribute them.
So did she know, your mother, that you were using these drugs when this started for her?
Yes. I had overdosed a couple times by that point.
Jeez.
So...
Do you remember, Aaron, the first time that your mom talked to you about oxycodone differently? What I mean is, when she went from being your mom and probably concerned about you and your relationship to this.
To hey, let's make a lot of money selling drugs.
Right.
I do remember her telling me that she was thinking about going to Florida. Hmm. And I couldn't tell you how ecstatic I was to hear that. I just knew I could manipulate my mother into giving me free drugs.
So you'd gotten to a point where nothing about that troubled you.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was fantastic news. It was great news. But it is no fault to my mother, because my mother was a fantastic mother when I was growing up. She never missed a ball game that I had, and there were many of those. She was there every single holiday, and then not to say that it was just ball games and holidays. Like, she was obviously there a lot. Mm-hmm. She would show up for meetings with the school. She was a normal, good mother.
Aaron, how do you make sense of people's parents doing this? Did you grow up in a community with a lot of friends whose parents needed money?
Yes. Yeah. This is the recession. This is 2008, 2009, 10, 11. Yes, for sure. This was for financial gain.
And it sounds like once this place is so awash in drugs that there's really no possibility of anybody really running out of it, because
No. It wasn't until they actually shut the Florida down and FASPR was implemented, which was the tracking of prescriptions, narcotics, and it really cut it in half. It didn't stop it, but it cut it in half.
And was that a big deal for your community?
That was a huge deal. A lot of people started then just going to one doctor instead of multiple, mm-hmm. But they were still going nonetheless. There were still doctors out there willing to write prescriptions. And by that time, prices of pills had jumped way up, and they were $45 a piece.
Wow.
And that's why heroin is as popular as it is right now.
Why?
It's a direct result of oxy and oxycontin and oxycodone and methadone being the supply of that being cut in half, and the street value of that jumping, almost doubling. And now heroin's cheaper and more potent.
Hmm.
So in any drug addict's mind, that's the best idea ever, is to just switch to heroin.
So a bunch of people, including many of them in the town where you grew up, get addicted to what are essentially legal drugs, perhaps illegally acquired. And that gets taken away from them through the shortages and these changes in the regulations. And then they turn to this cheaper but more potent and deadly illegal drug.
Absolutely. That is an extremely accurate characterization of it.
Hmm.
I would say that's 90% of the people I know, that's their story.
So can you tell me about the overdose that started to be the beginning of the end for you when it came to these drugs?
The night of my overdose, the last one that I had, I was up all night, cocaine and heroin. I had taken the last bit around 7 o'clock that morning and drove to my dad's house because I was going to go work with my dad that day. And I walked in the kitchen, and I just collapsed and went into convulsions again. And my grandmother walked in and because she heard my body hit the ground. And my dad was there. And the way you hear him describe it was, I'm just foaming, you know, erratically out of my mouth. And my grandmother's in the chair, and she's screaming and crying, call 911. And my brother comes out, and they're holding me in the kitchen floor. The next thing I know, I'm waking up, and the ambulance is there. And my dad's got me in his lap. My dad's a big guy. He's 6'5", about 250. And he has his 22-year-old son in his lap, just sitting on the couch, just rocking back and forth and crying. And I have no idea what just happened. And I looked at him and I was like, what is going on? He said, well, I think you just overdosed. I'm still denying my use to my dad at this point. I said, that doesn't make any sense. I haven't used any drugs, though I had been using drugs all night.
It seems like it would have been impossible at this point for him to ignore the problem.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. By that point, I had stolen everything that wasn't nailed down. He would find syringes in my pockets of my jeans all the times when I would stay there. It was just undeniable. But I would still try.
So what happens after that?
After that, my dad kicked me out and told me that I wasn't allowed back at the house. It was crippling the entire family. My substance abuse alone was crippling the entire family. It had came to the point where I didn't have anywhere else to go, and I ended up sleeping anywhere that I could.
I have to say, your life at this point sounds...
It's miserable. Yeah, it goes on like that for a while. It gets to the point where I had sold the shoes off of my feet for crack, and I was shooting crack behind a dumpster in the apartment complex that where I'm from. That's where it got.
How do you finally stop doing these drugs? It sounds like selling your shoes off the bottom of your feet and shooting up behind a dumpster is a version of rock bottom.
I just remember thinking that I just want a break from this insanity. So there was a bed open at a detox facility. And the atmosphere of this treatment facility was unlike any other treatment facility that I had ever been in. Everyone that was working on staff was a recovered drug addict or alcoholic. And I would say the catalyst for this changing of events would be another guy looking at me and telling me how he had felt the way that I had felt and used the way that I had used.
Mm-hmm.
But now, where he was homeless, he's now a homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a contributing member of society, and he shows up for work every single day. And he is happy, and he's free.
How long has it been, Aaron, since you last used?
August 7th, 2015.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Are you surprised that you're still alive?
Absolutely. By everyone's standards, I should be dead.
And have you seen a lot of people who actually do die from this?
I attend a funeral about once every 6 months, at least.
Of the people that you work with, that you grew up with?
Yeah, all around. They're dying left and right.
A few months after Aaron stopped using opioids, his mother told him she wanted help too. Aaron took her to the same treatment facility that helped him recover. She has been clean ever since. We'll be right back.
As you all know from personal experience, families, communities, and citizens across our country are currently dealing with the worst drug crisis in American history, and even, if you really think about it, world history.
Julie, what did we expect President Trump to do on Thursday?
Well, President Trump has been talking for months about the fact that he considers the opioid crisis a national emergency.
Julie Davis covers the White House for The Times.
And so we expected for him to either announce or actually sign a declaration that this is a national emergency, which would then unleash federal funding and all sorts of authorities for the federal government to deal with a crisis that's killed tens of thousands of people in the last year.
We can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. We can do it.
So with that in mind, what ended up happening on Thursday?
So President Trump actually didn't declare it a national emergency in the way that people expected him to do.
That is why, effective today, my administration is officially declaring the opioid crisis a national public health emergency under federal law.
He directed his administration, rather, to declare it a public health emergency, which is still a designation that is designed to have the symbolic impact of saying, hey, guys, this is a big problem. We need to turn the resources of the federal government to solving it. But it doesn't have the same sorts of impacts that declaring a national emergency would have in terms of urgent emergency federal funding that automatically gets unlocked when that kind of a declaration is made.
What are the big differences between these two kinds of declarations, and why is it significant that he chose one over the other?
So if you're declaring a national emergency, you're basically saying that this is an emergency that requires the government to spend emergency funds in a rapid manner to address this issue. If you're instead calling it a public health emergency, that is a different legal authority that essentially says you should allow the relaxation, perhaps, of rules and regulations to be able to deal with this. You should direct existing grant programs to deal with this problem. But it doesn't, in and of itself, provide any money. And any money that's going to be spent will have to be allocated by Congress in a separate action.
And what do we know, Julie, about why the administration chose to do it this way?
You know, when you talk to White House officials about this, they all believe that a national emergency designation was actually the wrong mechanism for this particular crisis, because there are so many demands already on FEMA money because of storms and other disasters that have occurred in the last several months. Essentially, when you're declaring a national emergency for a hurricane or for a flood, eventually the hurricane passes and the flood is over. But looking at the opioid crisis, it doesn't show any signs of ending anytime soon. So there was a worry that they were essentially signing themselves up for a completely open-ended commitment of federal resources. Now, they would argue that the measures that will result from this public health declaration are actually going to be a lot more impactful.
I am directing all executive agencies to use every appropriate emergency authority to fight the opioid crisis.
So now that the president has declared this a public health emergency, what is he asking his administration to do about it?
He's asking all of the agencies to look at their programs and figure out ways in which they can help combat the opioid epidemic.
The U.S. Postal Service and the Department of Homeland Security are strengthening the inspection of packages coming into our country to hold back the flood of cheap and deadly fentanyl, a synthetic opioid manufactured in China and 50 times stronger than heroin. And in 2 weeks, I will be in China with President Xi, and I will mention this as a top priority.
And there's also going to be, interestingly, and we've seen this in the past with drug problems that this country has experienced, a big advertising campaign.
This was an idea that I had where if we can teach young people not to take drugs, just not to take them, when I see friends of mine that are having difficulty with not having that drink at dinner, where it's literally almost impossible for them to stop, I say to myself, I can't even understand it. Why would that be difficult? But we understand why it is difficult. The fact is, if we can teach young people and people generally not to start, it's really, really easy not to take them. And I think that's going to end up being our most important thing. Really tough, really big, really great advertising. So we get to people before they start, so they don't have to go through the problems of what people are going through.
The president seemed to suggest that personal restraint was possible and could keep people from succumbing to this epidemic. But is that the way people in public health see it and talk about it?
Not at all. This is part of the reason that there were a lot of critics of the president's announcement, because there are many in the advocacy world and in the medical field who say that nothing is going to change with regard to the opioid crisis when you're dealing with substances that are so, so highly addictive, until we get to a place where treatment is paramount and you're gearing all of your resources toward that.
So what happens now? Is the administration in a position to actually address this crisis?
Well, one of the reasons it took so long for President Trump to make this declaration, he talked about it for months, is that he doesn't actually have the people in place to craft or, frankly, carry out a anti-opioid strategy. The nominee who he had chosen to be the drug czar, the head of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, had to withdraw last week because it was revealed that he had sided with basically the pharmaceutical industry on a measure that was designed to beef up law enforcement's ability to keep opioids off the black market. And that came just a few weeks after Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, resigned over his use of private jets funded by the taxpayers to take both official and personal trips. And President Trump has yet to nominate someone for either position. And of course, when he does, it could be months before they're ever confirmed. So it's unclear who's going to fill that void and who actually is going to be in charge of carrying out what the president laid out as his vision for this today.
Julie, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Here's what else you need to know today.
This was an enormous step in the direction toward getting comprehensive tax reform and tax cuts for middle-class families over the line, into law.
On Thursday, congressional Republicans passed a budget deal that allows them to move forward with a plan to cut federal taxes by as much as $1.5 trillion without a single Democratic vote. The measure, opposed by every Democrat in the House, contains language that would shield a tax bill from a Democratic filibuster, meaning it could pass the Senate with just 51 votes in a chamber where Republicans control 52 seats. Democratic House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi described the Republican characterization of the plan as being for the middle class as a con.
What the Republicans did today was to give an open path to this assault, an assault. It's a ripoff, a shakedown, a looting of the middle class. We want to do tax reform. We want to do it in a way that is fair, that has simplification, that has growth, that reduces the deficit, creates good-paying jobs, and keeps America number one. Instead, we have a budget that they put forth that does not do that.
The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom.
Lindsay Garrison, Rachel Quester, Annie Brown, Andy Mills, Christopher Worth, and Ike Sriskandaraja, with editing help from Larissa Anderson. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Brad Fisher is our technical manager. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to Peter Sale, Sam Dolnick, and Michaela Bouchard. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you Monday.